Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 7th of July, these are our main stories. The surprise winner of Iran's presidential election, the reformist Masoud Pezeshkian, has told supporters their votes have given hope to a dissatisfied society. We ask what his victory might mean for relations with the West. Hamas says a strike on a UN-run school in Gaza has killed at least 16 people. Israel says it was used by Hamas operatives. Also in this podcast, a fifth Democratic member of Congress has called on Joe Biden to withdraw from the US presidential race. And there's nervousness in France ahead of Sunday's second round vote that could bring in a far-right government.
As a black person in France, I am absolutely revolted and disgusted by what's going on right now. Our mainstream medias are saying nothing about the racist attacks that are now taking place daily.
We start in Iran. Where a jubilant crowd in Tehran greeted the newly elected president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who gave a short address at the shrine of the founder of the Iranian Revolution. Despite a relatively low turnout in Friday's election runoff, the so-called reformist candidate finished comfortably ahead of his hardline conservative rival. These were reactions of some Iranians.
I just hope the new government will do something to bring down inflation. Also, they must help with youth unemployment. But overall, happy Mr. Pezeshkian won. And he must stop the morality police harassing women on a daily basis.
I have a positive feeling about Pezeshkian for now. He made many promises and must fulfill them. He's in favour of talks with the West and likely sanctions will be lifted. And that's good news for us.
But not everyone was celebrating. Freelance journalist Faresh Tehsadighi described the mood in Tehran.
People in Iran generally have become depoliticized. When you become depoliticized, it shows itself first in the election. People don't go and don't vote because they feel that there is no change. There is no need to change anything because it is as it is. There were some moods of celebrations last night around 3 or 4 in the morning, also in Tehran. But, you know, the numbers were in hundreds, not even thousands. Conservative households, they were upset. They were totally upset because the majority of them had voted for Mr. Jalili. They felt upset. They felt disappointed.
Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian told me what we'd heard so far from the new president.
Not very much. He was scheduled to hold a press conference, but the press conference was cancelled. We understand the reason was that he had a private meeting with the supreme leader. But then he went to the shrine of the founder of the revolution, and amid scenes of chaos, he delivered a brief address. It was noteworthy that he said, had it not been for the supreme leader, which he thanked, that his name would have not come out of the ballot box, perhaps hinting at the impression that he's a semi-anti-establishment candidate and that the hardliners would not swallow his presidency so easily.
How much freedom will he have to operate, given that state policy is decided by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei?
Well, if he can build consensus, if he can convince the supreme leader to get on board with his policies, then he can pull it off, as was the case back in 2015, where you had a moderate president, Hassan Rouhani, which back then, with the backing of the supreme leader, managed to strike a nuclear deal with the West, only to have a Donald Trump presidency withdraw from that deal, thereby confirming the misgivings and suspicions of the supreme leader. It'll be more difficult to get him on board this time, but given the crippling effect of U.S. economic sanctions, it might be easy as well.
What is the mood in Iran with the election of a new president?
It really depends on who you're talking to. Voter turnout was 50% this time, 10% more than the first round of voting last week, which means that a lot more Iranians turned out to vote at fear of the possibility that a hardliner might become president. However, still half of the people who could vote did not vote. Some are speaking of the revival of a reformist movement, and some were bitterly opposed to the regime and are dissatisfied, believe that there's no difference between any of the politicians that emerge from this clerical establishment.
Siavash Ardalan. As we've been hearing, the election came amid domestic discontent over the state of Iran's sanction-hit economy and the dispute with the West over Iran's nuclear program, in which a change of US president could make a new deal impossible. Owen Bennett-Jones has been speaking to Kelsey Davenport, who's Director for Non-Proliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. How does she think policymakers in Washington might respond to the election of a reformist president in Iran?
The Biden administration should try to take advantage of this narrow window between, you know, Pezeshkian coming into office and the U.S. presidential election to try to reduce nuclear risk. So there may be some spaces around the edges to reduce tension and reduce the proliferation risk posed by Iran's nuclear program. But, you know, we shouldn't expect, you know, significant changes or any movement towards negotiations on a comprehensive deal until after the U.S. presidential election.
When you talk about a comprehensive deal, isn't the time for that past? Because Iran must be very close now to having a bomb if it doesn't already have one.
Well, Iran is on the threshold of nuclear weapons. So if the political decision was made to develop a bomb, you know, Tehran could move very quickly to produce enough nuclear material to actually build a weapon. But U.S. intelligence continues to assess that Iran is not actually taking those steps. And one thing that I think is important, in Pezeshkian's campaigning, he talked about wanting to re-engage the West. He talked about wanting to re-engage on the nuclear program. Now, the 2015 nuclear deal is dead. Iran's nuclear program is too far advanced to resurrect that accord. But for Iran to receive the sanctions relief it wants, for Iran to engage with the region, you know, it needs some sanctions lifting from the United States. And that really is only going to come if Iran is willing to take steps to roll back its nuclear program. So there still is time for the United States and its international partners to try to negotiate constraints on Iran's nuclear program, but it's critical that the United States move quickly to demonstrate its resolve and intent, and first in these coming months try to de-escalate tensions. Because given the regional situation, given Iran's threshold status, there are a number of factors that could tip Iran towards nuclear weapons if there isn't a serious effort to try to de-escalate now.
And just on, you know, the other big thing going on in the Middle East, the conflict in Gaza and the threat of an Israeli attack on southern Lebanon. Are you expecting the new president to have any role in that at all, or is he just waiting for events and see what happens?
I think that Iran is going to continue to, you know, support its partners and proxies in the region. At the same time, Iran will likely continue to balance that support, you know, with continuing to reiterate that it is not interested in opening a broader conflict with Israel, you know, and the United States, and that the United States and Israel don't miscalculate Iran's nuclear intentions and prematurely resort to force to roll back the program.
Kelsey Davenport, Director for Non-Proliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says an attack on a school near a crowded market has killed at least 16 people and injured dozens more. Witnesses told the BBC that the attack struck the upper floors of the school in Al-Nuzirat in central Gaza, which was sheltering thousands of displaced Palestinians. A video of the aftermath shows a smoke-filled street full of dust and rubble and people rushing to find the dead and injured. This witness described what he saw.
We ran out to see the targeted area. We saw bodies of children. This is a playground. There was a trampoline here. There were swings and vendors. Civilians were killed. It's a civilian school. These are United Nations schools for UNRWA. It's supposed to be safe for people. They shouldn't ever be targeted. After every strike, we find bodies blown to pieces. We do not see identifiable human bodies.
The Israeli military has confirmed it carried out the strike, saying that the UN-run school was used by Hamas operatives as a command centre. The IDF also said it took numerous steps to mitigate the risk of harming civilians. A spokesman for the emergency services in Gaza said the attack showed that nowhere was safe in the enclave for families seeking shelter. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher is in Jerusalem.
A school in the centre of Gaza, in a refugee camp, Nusayrat refugee camp, was hit. Around 7,000 displaced people were taking refuge there. These scenes are still being repeated across the whole of Gaza. Up in Gaza City in the north, a battle has been raging in one district there, where Israeli forces have been battling against Hamas and other Palestinian armed factions, while right down in the south in Rafah, the Israeli military operation is still continuing there. And just a few days ago, to the east of Khan Yunus, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were told that they had to evacuate. All of this shows that fighting is still continuing in Gaza. It underlines the urgency as momentum is building once again towards a resumption of ceasefire talks and to finally secure the release of all remaining hostages in Gaza, dead or alive. Hamas gave its response to the latest proposal, which was presented by President Biden several weeks ago. It appears to be a positive response. It may even have finally overcome what's been the main stumbling block, the demand by Hamas that there must be a permanent ceasefire before any movement forward. We will still have to see if Israel, the Israeli government, can accept that and make perhaps some concession itself about its demand that it must be able to continue fighting if necessary after any ceasefire.
Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. French voters are going to the polls on Sunday in the decisive second round of parliamentary elections that could see a far-right government formed in France for the first time since World War II. The multiracial Paris suburb of Seine-Saint-Denis has featured prominently in the campaign. It's the hometown of Jordan Bardella, the young prime ministerial candidate for Marine Le Pen's national rally, and of France's football team captain, Kylian Mbappe, who said last week's first round of voting, which saw the national rally come first, was catastrophic. The BBC's James Kumarasamy went to some of the final campaigning in a part of Seine-Saint-Denis where Marine Le Pen's party is trying to beat the candidate from the left-wing New Popular Front coalition.
It's the last day of school and there's quite a crowd of little kids and parents here outside the primary school in Villemomble, and there's one extra person here. It is the socialist candidate for this area. She nearly got the 50% needed to be re-elected in the first round, but she just missed out. She is facing someone from the national rally, and she's trying to persuade everyone here to give her vote.
Make sure your friends go and vote. The message from Fatia Keloa Ashi to one of the mums waiting at the school gates. The former French teacher is battling for re-election in a runoff against the national rally. She told me what was at stake.
L'enjeu principalement c'est malheureusement.
The first big deal is to avoid a government with an extreme right, because it's one of the big deal that we have today with this election.
Among her supporters handing out leaflets, one young woman with an international perspective.
My name is Jeanne. I'm 19 years old. I grew up in France in Rosny-sous-Bois, but I lived in the US for 2 years.
How do you think the world is looking on at France at the moment?
I don't think anybody really expected for the far-right parties to get that much approval from the electors. I think everyone is judging France very harshly right now, and they're right to do so.
Not far from the school, waiting for her bus, I meet 27-year-old Doriane. She's upset and angry at France's precarious political situation and at a president whose unprompted decision to hold this election has, she says, opened a Pandora's box.
People don't need Macron to be racist, but he did enable something to happen, and he doesn't care. I don't know exactly what he's
endgame is, but it's disgusting. And as a black person in France, I am absolutely revolted and disgusted by what's going on right now and by the fact that our mainstream medias are saying nothing about the racist attacks that are now taking place daily since the Assemblée Nationale was dissolved.
The National Rally says some of its candidates have also been attacked in a country that feels on the edge. But of what? We couldn't ask its local candidate, who said he was unavailable. But the party's leader, whose face is on the posters in this suburb, Jordan Bardella, says the answer is simple: change.
I believe that the National Rally can win this election on Sunday with an absolute majority. I intend to form a national unity government and to implement the recovery project that I presented to the country. I'm the only person to talk about the substance and to talk about the daily lives of the French, the cost of living, security and immigration.
The socialists should come out top in this metropolitan multiracial constituency, but they're partly to blame for the populist right's continuing success in France, according to Paris-based author and journalist Andrew Hussey.
And I do think, you know, whatever happens on Sunday, if the National Rally move forward, you have to point the finger at the failure of the left. And two huge blocks in the left, the Socialist Party and, you know, prior to that, the Communist Party, have left working-class people of all ethnic persuasions feeling abandoned and lost. And the National Rally, who are very statist in the economic policies, who promised to nationalise this and who promised to nationalise that, they promise that, you know, you won't be at the service of globalised market forces. You will again be in charge of your destiny. And it's a very enticing promise.
But will that be enough to take the National Rally into government? A scenario that many in France clearly want, but plenty of others fear.
James Kumarasamy. Warfare leaves behind many elements that often take decades to resolve. A good example is landmines that continue to kill and maim, sometimes many years after the end of conflict. Now Japan is to work with Cambodia on a complex international project to help detect and remove landmines. Viv Marsh has this report.
Cambodia's recent history has made it the reluctant emblem of the demining industry. The Indochina Wars, the Vietnam War, the rule of the Khmer Rouge and the insurgency that followed left Cambodia strewn with millions of mines and other unexploded ordnance. Thousands of people have been killed by landmines since the Khmer Rouge was driven from power in 1979. Thousands more have had limbs amputated because of their injuries. Only last year, a school was closed after more than 2,000 explosive devices were found. Through this suffering, Cambodia has emerged as a world leader in landmine countermeasures, and its government aims to clear it of hidden explosives by next year. Under the Enhanced Cooperation Agreement with Japan, Cambodia will serve as a hub for training and knowledge sharing on landmines, while Japan will provide expertise in mine detectors and AI technology that predicts where devices may have been laid. One beneficiary will be Ukraine, which has been littered with landmines and explosive remnants since Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago. Ukrainian personnel will be trained on Japanese demining equipment in Cambodia as early as next month.
Viv Marsh. Still to come in this podcast. Why the authorities in Pakistan are concerned about the annual commemoration of the holy month of Muharram. Power cuts in Ukraine have been getting longer and more frequent as Russia continues to target the country's energy system. 100,000 people are without power in the northeastern Sumy region after one such attack. As a result, electricity needs to be rationed. That creates serious problems for millions of Ukrainians. No running water, lifts or access to life-saving medical equipment. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
Over the past 3 months alone, Ukraine has lost 9 gigawatts of generating capacity, the national energy company Ukrenergo says, and this is more than a third of the capacity that Ukraine had before the full-scale invasion. Ukrenergo spokeswoman Maria Tsatorian says the situation is unprecedented.
All state-owned thermal power plants are destroyed. Actually, all thermal power plants and all hydropower plants in our country damaged with Russian missiles or drones. So, of course, this lack of generation caused a deficit in the power grid.
To cope, Ukrenergo has had to implement a policy of sweeping power cuts across the country, which last for many hours a day, every day. But for some, uninterrupted power supplies are literally a matter of life and death. Here's Tatiana from Odessa. Her son was born disabled and needs electricity-powered equipment to be able to breathe, to be fed and to receive medication.
We're very dependent on electricity. If it wasn't for this bloody war, life would be difficult, but we'd be able to cope. Because of the endless power cuts, it's extremely difficult. We need to make sure there's a constant supply of electricity. We've got a generator which runs on petrol, but it needs to be topped up all the time. It runs for 6 hours at a time and then it has to be stopped, because it needs to cool down and we need to top up the fuel. And then we restart it to get the electricity flowing again.
Tatiana says power cuts also affect mobile phone coverage, so getting through to the ambulance service is a struggle. The capital, Kyiv, has also been suffering lengthy power cuts. Roxolana was elected by residents of her 24-story apartment block to help run the building's facilities.
It's not easy living in tower blocks because power cuts also mean no running water on the upper floors. The lifts are not working either, so mothers with children and disabled people have to wait. They plan their trips outside depending on when there's electricity. They've got to stay indoors for 6 hours on end. Our elderly ladies can't pop out to the shops to get their bread.
So many residents in tall buildings are stuck inside sweltering apartments because air conditioning isn't working. And they're also further exposed to Russian airstrikes because they are unable to go down to the bomb shelter. In Zaporizhia, dentist Vladimir Stefanyev uses a head torch to perform minor operations during blackouts. But there have been occasions when electricity disappeared during complicated surgery.
If this happens, we start our generators so we can finish what we have begun. There's no other way. We can't tell the patient to come back tomorrow.
Power cuts in the summer are hugely disruptive, but Ukrainians fear to think what will happen in winter if Russia continues pounding their energy system.
Vitaly Shevchenko reporting. Another day, and another Democratic member of the US Congress has called on President Biden to drop out of November's election race. Some public opinion polls have shown Donald Trump widening a lead since the debate, and a Reuters Ipsos poll found that one in three Democrats want Biden to quit the race. On Friday, in a television interview, Mr. Biden had insisted he was the best person to stand, despite what he called his bad night during last week's TV debate with Donald Trump. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
In all, five Democrats in the House of Representatives have called on Joe Biden to step aside. The latest to come forward is Angie Craig, a member from the state of Minnesota. She said she didn't believe that the president could effectively campaign and win against Donald Trump. There was, she said, simply too much at stake, and Mr. Biden should make way for a new generation of leaders. While no senior members of the party have called on the president to quit, the unease amongst Democrats is palpable. In an interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos, the president blamed his disastrous debate performance on a bad cold. Asked whether he would take a cognitive test and release the results, he said it wasn't necessary because his mental ability was challenged every day through his work. He warned of dire consequences if Donald Trump were to win the election and insisted he was the most qualified candidate to stop the former president.
And if you stay in and Trump is elected and everything you're warning about comes to pass, how will you feel in January?
I feel as long as I gave it my all and I did the goodest job as I know I can do. That's what this is about.
Mr. Biden added that only the Lord Almighty could convince him to abandon his bid for a second term in the White House.
Peter Bowes. The Pakistani authorities are always anxious about the annual commemoration of Muharram when Shias throughout the country take to the streets in huge numbers, some of them using blades to slash their backs as people around them chant. This is from last year's Muharram. It's a time of heightened communal tensions, and most years there are extremists who try to disrupt the events, sometimes with violence. Well, this year, 143 Pakistani clerics are facing bans on their speeches and travel to try to prevent them causing trouble. Hassan Abbas is now a professor at National Defence University in Washington, D.C., but he used to be in the Pakistani police. So what does he think of these restraining orders? Will they work?
Not really. I find this a bit ironic that they have curtailed these rights, I would say, of these 140 scholars, both from the Shia background and the Sunni background. But this is in the context of Muharram, when the when most Muslims and especially Shias and Sufis commemorate the death anniversary of a grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Hussein, and his 72 members of the family. But this indirectly says that you are allowed to give hate-filled speeches throughout the year, and only in these 10 days or 20 days you have to stop. So you are free to create the environment of hatred for the rest of the year, and these days you stop them. So this is a very strange old tactic, I don't think it is going to really impact.
Well, yes, I take your point, but it is a time of heightened tension, isn't it? And the police are always worried. In fact, you were in the police. You worked in the Pakistani police, and you had to deal with worrying about keeping these things peaceful.
That is true. However, I understand the logic. And today, to give them this extra benefit of the doubt, given the impact of social media, these things can very quickly escalate. So if there's one clip, and you can pick some clip out of a long speech and which is out of context, and you say, look, this is what is happening, this is blasphemous, or they are ridiculing Shias, or Shias are saying terrible things about Sunnis, or the revered personalities, and it can, the social media, and given what has happened in Pakistan in against Christians in Punjab, also in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, against some of the people who were killed, who were lynched to death. So I understand their point, that they're thinking no such thing should create a stir and lead to this. But however, this should be part of a longer policy. When people who are known to give such terrible speeches and create hatred should be stopped or prosecuted in a legal sense when they do such things throughout, because they are being profiled. But why especially to pick this time to go for such an action?
Now then, the Shias make up, actually you'll have a much better number than me, but what, 15 to 20% of the population, and yet these commemorative events and these massive street processions happen right throughout the cities of Pakistan, don't they?
That is true. I would say, based on what scholars say, yes, 15 to 20%, they go up to 25%. That's between 20 and 25 might be more accurate. However, in certain areas, especially urban centres, Shias might be more in numbers. Secondly, they are traditionally, since old times, in these processions, especially on the 10th of Muharram, when it is called Ashura, that is when many Sunnis also come out. So many Sufi-oriented Sunnis also come out. But many Sunnis, this was part, and I personally, at a personal level, I come from a mixed family with both Shia and Sunni traditions, and I know that this is commemorated among the Sunnis as well in a big way. So the big processions you see are maybe 80% or 70% Shias, but 20 to 30% are the Sunnis also.
That was Hassan Abbas, a professor at the National Defence University in Washington, D.C., speaking to the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. A French cyclist has been fined about $225 after he stopped to kiss his wife and two-year-old son during a time trial at this year's Tour de France. The International Cycling Union said it brought the image of the sport into disrepute. Judy Frankel reports.
Julien Bernard did not expect to win Friday's time trial, but the 32-year-old Frenchman did something he'll treasure for the rest of his life. With the race held very close to his home in Burgundy, the little Trek rider was greeted by crowds of cheering supporters as he cycled past them. As he reached the top of the climb, friends ran towards him holding signs, and his wife stepped forward, holding their son, and gave him a quick kiss. In a television interview afterwards, Bernard said his wife had planned the encounter weeks before and that he'd cycled faster at the beginning so he would have enough time to greet them.
It was amazing. In modern cycling, it's not easy to stop and see your family. But here, with the time trial, it was perfect because I could take the time to really savour it. And I did. It was incredible.
The governing body fined him for what it called unseemly or inappropriate behaviour during the race and damaging the image of the sport. Writing on social media, Bernard apologised for any damage he may have caused, but said he would happily pay the fine every day to experience the moment again.
Judy Frankel reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Cazares and the producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.